Caleb, Lauriana, thanks you so, so much. And I will hear from you next.
Hello and welcome to The Wire, independent coverage of current affairs on your local community radio station. I'm Roderick Chambers, and coming up on The Wire today...
Jobs, all different states of life getting involved, both old and young, because we haven't seen something of this passion and this length occur possibly ever in the history of modern China.
Protests in Hong Kong have been going on for over 11 weeks now, and there appears to be no end in sight. Stakes for the people of Hong Kong are high, but so it is also for the Chinese government. Also on the program tonight...
That is not a lawful way to go about raising a debt. We say that shifts the onus onto the Centrelink recipient.
Centrelink computers have been working overtime, clawing back debts from people who have little ability to fight back, commonly known as robo-debts. But the GetUp group are developing a way for the ordinary person to help them fight back against these computerised debt programs. Stay tuned for all of this and more coming up on The Wire. The federal government's contentious Centrelink data matching project, or robo-debt as it is popularly known, is now facing a second Senate inquiry. Officially entitled the Online Income Compliance Intervention, the scheme aims to claw back money welfare recipients have already been paid through Centrelink. GetUp has plans for a new online service to help those impacted by the scheme. Rob Osborne has the story.
The government has rejected all criticism of their robo-debt initiative. Despite a previous Senate inquiry calling for the scheme to be suspended, the government is expanding its scope. Here's Federal Minister for Government Services, Stuart Robert, speaking recently on the ABC.
In the last 4 or 5 years, the department has recovered $1.9 billion in overpayments, and we have a legal responsibility to do that. People need to keep their affairs or their income assessments up to date. You know, using MyGov as one example, they can use a telephony channel or they can go into a Centrelink office to have a discussion or provide documentation.
The experiences of many recipients of robo-debt notices shows the reality is rather more complex and daunting than the minister suggests. GetUp is one of several campaigning organisations that have provided help for those with alleged debts. Ed Miller, Economic Fairness Campaigns Director at GetUp, explains how their FraudStop platform works.
Yeah, FraudStop was a program, or it's a platform that we initiated in 2017 in response to the government's robo-debt crisis, which at the time was revealed to have massive levels of fraudulent letters being sent out to people who didn't actually owe debts, or who owed debts that were substantially less than what was alleged. And one of the really difficult parts of dealing with that punitive system for a lot of people is getting started. You get a threatening letter in the mail, you know, that says that you owe the government money and there's consequences if you don't pay it. And people didn't understand at the time that you had the right to challenge it, and they didn't understand how to challenge it. And so what FraudStop did is it provided a starting point for people. You know, it sends off an application that appeals the actual debt itself. It notifies people's local MP in case they can intervene in the matter. And it also sends off an automatic Freedom of Information request that helps people get access to the data that Centrelink already has.
There have also been attempts to challenge the legal basis of the process used to assess and calculate alleged debts. Victoria Legal Aid is conducting two test cases in the federal court. I asked Joel Townsend, their manager of economic and social rights, to explain the legal arguments that underpin these cases.
Centrelink takes data from the Australian Taxation Office about income received, and because that's not broken into fortnightly instalments, Centrelink averages it over a period. We say that is not a lawful way to go about raising a debt. we say that shifts the onus onto the Centrelink recipient. And where Centrelink has lots of information gathering powers, and once it's decided that there's a debt, lots of enforcement powers, we say that it has to be properly and reasonably satisfied that a debt to the Commonwealth exists. We say this kind of averaging process can't possibly tell you whether in a given fortnight somebody has properly declared their income or not. And so if you don't know that, you can't raise a debt and pursue it using all of those powers.
In the meantime, GetUp plans to develop the FraudStop platform into a more useful tool for those faced with robo-debts. Ed Miller again.
One of the things that we're thinking about doing is finding a solution for people who don't have access to a desktop computer with the internet and sometimes don't have access to the internet at all. And what that could look like is a chatbot that allows people via text message or SMS or even Facebook Messenger to go through the same kinds of processes that the original FraudStop form takes people through and gives them a far more easier and interactive way to initiate their claim.
Ed Miller from GetUp, ending that report from Rob Osborne. In 2014, temporary protection visas were used by then Immigration Minister Scott Morrison as a deterrent to people arriving in Australia by boat. Whilst boats have stopped landing in Australia, there are now approximately 30,000 people living under TPVs. Currently, TPV holders will never be able to apply for permanent residency in Australia, adding to the constant threat of deportation. Those on TPVs have restricted access to travel, study and welfare. Julia Andre has more.
Yesterday, pleas for freedom were shouted by refugees outside the Department of Immigration and Border Protection in Sydney CBD. The group was protesting current government policy, which blocks those on temporary protection visas, or TPVs, from accessing permanent citizenship. But perhaps the biggest toll for these refugees is their inability to help their families escape war and persecution back at home. Zaki Haidari escaped Afghanistan 7 years ago and is now working at the ANU in Canberra. But for Zaki, his fears for his family are all-consuming.
I have to call my mom almost every night before I go to bed because the security situation is really bad and it's getting worse every day. I call them to see how they're doing and if they're okay because if there's a bomb goes off every day or something else happens, I'm panicking to find out if they're okay. I could lose them in any moment.
According to Human Rights Watch, Australia is the only country to grant temporary protection status to refugees who have been recognised as genuinely in need of protection, according to the 1951 Refugee Convention. The instability of Zaki's stay has left him feeling desperate.
I feel safe physically. There's nothing harm. Like, if I compare myself to one of my brother, when they go out in the morning, they don't know if they will be back home by the evening. At least I don't have that concern. So I'm physically safe. But yeah, mentally, I am not safe at all. I keep worrying, how long do I have the safety that I have at the moment, because it is temporary. But for my family, I do worry a lot for them. So every time that bombs goes off or someone is dead, I get panic, take my phone, call mom to check if my siblings are okay.
Uniting Justice Australia has claimed that TPVs will create a second class of refugees in Australia who are stuck in a cycle of poverty and disadvantage. In her work, Sarah Dale, the principal lawyer at Refugee Advice and Casework Services, has seen the despair these refugees are experiencing firsthand.
I think there's a real sense of lethal hopelessness for those that hold temporary protection visas and safe haven enterprise visas. People are desperately trying to meet the criteria of those visas to try and hope to access some kind of pathway for permanency so that they can get access to things like family reunion. The reality is, though, those pathways are completely blocked with hurdle after hurdle, and the reality is that these visas are only going to lead to further temporariness And therefore, those hurdles will remain and people will remain here unsettled without any sense of stability, without any sense of a future and separated from their families.
Right. As the only dedicated provider of free legal advice to refugees in New South Wales and without government funding, Refugee Advice and Casework Services faces a challenge in serving its clients' needs. Particularly as the government has given no indication of what the reapplication process for TPVs will entail.
People have had to make those reapplications, people have had to lodge those forms. But we haven't really seen the reapplication process moving yet. So as lawyers, we can't really advise people on what to expect because we ourselves haven't seen it yet and don't necessarily know.
Working to provide for his family back in Afghanistan, Zaki hopes his uncertain future includes permanent citizenship in Australia.
I have been living in Australia for over 7 years and I do feel like I'm an Australian citizen, not by the paper, but the feeling that I have for Australia and the community. Like I think it would be really nice if I could call Australia my permanent home. But I know it's a big ask. But the other thing that I would have asked was, even if I could have my family here with me, for even if my visa is expiring in the next 2 years, if I can have my family for the next 2 years with me, and to give them a break from the war zone, to have with me in a peaceful environment, and I don't have to worry about them. Even if it's temporary, it would mean the world for me and my family. Just experience, you know, the peaceful environment with them together, and not to worry what's happening with them and what's happening with me.
Refugee Zaki Haidari, ending that report by Julia Andre.
Hey there, I'm Hamish McDonald. Around Australia, you're listening to The Wire. Take it easy.
Flights to Hong Kong were cancelled from Sydney this morning, although the Hong Kong International Airport was again opened. Some protesters have stayed at the airport overnight, but it appears that moving protests show no sign of abating. Monica Attard is a Walkley Award-winning Australian journalist and the head of journalism at the University of Technology Sydney, and she's currently at Hong Kong Airport, a first-hand witness to the protests.
We were the last flight in last night before they closed the airport, so we were the last flight that was allowed to land, and we were just transiting through for a night and day. We're leaving tonight, we hope, we think, we're not sure, for Delhi.
Right,
maybe
okay.
We're leaving and maybe we're not.
Yes.
Because so, flights are being cancelled left, right and centre.
Oh, goodness. So, look, you've arrived in Hong Kong and at the airport there. What is it that you found when you arrived?
Well, we arrived in the arrivals lounge to see that there were many thousands of students, and that was the thinned-out version. Apparently, just an hour and a half before, there were many, 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 many more thousands of students there. But when we arrived, as I say, it was very crowded, it was very loud. They were imploring people who were arriving to listen to them very gently. A lot of them apologising for the disruption because they'd been made aware that the authorities had closed the airport. So they were very apologetic for the disruption, but wanting people, giving us pamphlets, wanting us to listen and talk to them because they're now at the point of desperation, you know, you feel. So, and at the same time, of course, there are protests that are continuing on the streets in the centre of Hong Kong itself, in the city. So, you know, there's no diminution of their zeal to get what they want here, and clearly the authorities are clamping down as well. There is fear that the military would be deployed, but of course there is absolutely no visible sign of that as yet. But we heard that this afternoon, it's now Tuesday, and we heard that this afternoon, well, I was at the airport this morning, I just wanted to have a look to see how many had stayed overnight. A few had stayed overnight, but not a large number, but they said that the reinforcements were coming at between 1 and 2 o'clock and they were ramping up the protests again there.
And how tense do you think it is, I mean, compared to all the other hot spots you've been in around the world in your career?
Look, you know, I certainly don't get a feeling that it's tinderbox tense. you know. I mean, I don't feel that. I don't feel any danger at all. But of course, the danger arises when the authorities decide that they're going to do something about it. But right now, it doesn't feel dangerous. That is at the airport. In the city, it's another matter altogether, where the police have been very, very heavy-handed and very, very active. That's another question altogether. But certainly at the airport, which is the focus at the moment, it doesn't feel at all dangerous. There are a lot of security police, airport security police, milling around. Certainly this morning they were building up and caucusing. You could see them talking in groups all over the airport, but no state police.
And do you think that people are really angry with Carrie Lam, or is it really Beijing?
Oh, I think they're angry with both. And I don't think they make a distinction between Carrie Lam and the regime in Beijing. They're disappointed and they're upset and they're frightened. I mean, they really do feel as though they're losing control of their territory. And, you know, they don't feel it. You know, one passport, two systems. They feel it's one passport, one and a half systems. And that's, for them, not good enough. I certainly don't get any feeling that these young people are going to be giving up anytime soon. And that's the other notable thing about it. I'm struck by how young they are. I mean, these are all very, very young university students. And they have a lot to lose because it's their future that they believe is at stake. So I certainly don't feel as though they're going to be giving up anytime soon.
Is there any feeling that there's a big effect on business there?
Well, not that I can see, but again, you know, I've been focusing out here at the airport, so I haven't seen what's happening in the city. But I did catch a train into the centre of Hong Kong this morning, and I thought the trains were particularly empty, to be honest. And I don't know whether I'm sure that's not the norm. But I'm not in a position to say because I haven't been on the ground in the city for long enough to actually make a determination. But, you know, certainly the reports are of flight capital certainly there are reports of capital fleeing the territory, which doesn't surprise me in the slightest. And as we saw this morning, the stock market has also taken a very, very significant hit this morning after what happened at the airport yesterday. So there will be residual economic effects. That always happens in situations like this. But I don't think the students are at all focused on that. For them, this is a life and death situation. For them, this is their future. There would be no... The Hong Kong that they were born into won't exist, they believe, if they don't grapple this problem now.
Professor Monica Attard, Head of Journalism at the University of Technology, Sydney, and at the airport there in Hong Kong, speaking with me. I'm Roderick Chambers, and you're listening to The Wire around Australia on the Community Radio Network. The National Indigenous Music Awards celebrated First Nations musicians over the weekend. The event came as more Indigenous musicians are reaching a larger national and even international audience to tell their stories through music. Kevin Suarez has this report.
The National Indigenous Music Awards were held over the weekend and saw Baker Boy and Mojo Juju taking out the top gongs. The award-winning musicians had different approaches to telling their own stories, with some incorporating their own language and dialects into their songs, while others sang about their identity.
My great-granddaddy was Wiradjuri. My father came here from the Philippines.
Mark Smith is the Executive Director of Music NT, the awards event producer, and reflected on this year's winners.
It was an interesting reflection of the new guard coming through. You know, I think having someone like Mojo Juju winning some of those key awards and Baker Boy taking out Artist of the Year, it's showing that there's such a depth in this scene at the moment. Like, you know, having Tasman and Dallas and, you know, even Accent weren't there, like Thelma... Kate wasn't playing, but there's an exciting sort of new wave of Indigenous music coming through, and I think that's really healthy for the sector, and it was really great that the awards reflected that.
Baker Boy took out the top award for Artist of the Year, a year after being named as the best new talent.
You got me feeling myself, now put it on you.
His grandfather, Bob Baker, explained how the community reacted to the win.
As you can guess, we're very proud of him out here. He's born at Melingimbi and grew up at Melingimbi and did some schooling also at Maningrida. So we're all, both Melingimbi and Maningrida, both isolated Arnhem Land communities, we're both proud, all proud of him.
Ever since he was young, Bob said Baker Boy, real name Dan Zell, had an interest in getting into performing arts. He particularly had an interest in dancing, something which was reflected in his song Muriyuna, a Yolongu word meaning to freestyle dance. Mr. Baker looks back at Dan Zell's growing interest in dancing.
From a young bloke, his grandmother, like my wife, Janjay, is a local girl, Melingimbi. And he grew up here and he took on dancing with our local dancers called the Melingimbi Island Dancers, who his grandma commenced the Melingimbi Island Dancers many years ago when he was only a young boy. He grew up into our family group here dancing.
Mr. Baker says his grandson is still in touch with his roots.
Yeah, he's very much an island boy. He's still coming out and visiting the families and keeps in touch with us regularly. He put a show on here, Baker Boy and his team, last year at the local festival. So he's very popular and well-known. He's still keeping close to his families across, as well as performing right across Australia, across the nation, yeah.
Several music publications, such as Tone Deaf, said the awards were cementing proof that First Nations music wasn't just a genre, but a creative force, a sentiment Mr. Smith agreed with.
Oh, it's definitely a creative force. I think the idea, Indigenous music isn't a genre. It's a collection of lots of different musicians making lots of different music. I think that, you know, you've seen any of the music that's happening over the last 2 years or so, that it isn't a creative force. Like, these musicians are making waves across the country, but internationally too. You know, there's artists touring all over the world, and I think that's a really exciting place to be.
Mr. Smith explored how the event has grown in recent years.
Each year we look back at what was before and sort of wonder how we got there, but this year especially seemed to set a new benchmark for what the awards are capable of. I think, you know, it was a really eclectic lineup that presented, you know, what's happening across the board in the Indigenous music sector, which was amazing, like from both classical to sort of contemporary music and hip-hop. So that was really exciting. And I think, you know, we just saw thousands of people come in to celebrate this music, which was just, you know, really what the intent is of that event, to really provide this platform to showcase. And, you know, it felt like in many respects it had fully arrived this year, which was great.
He said he looks forward to next year and what direction the industry will take.
How do you go on from something that felt really amazing this year? And I think, you know, part of it is just continuing to make sure that the event reflects what's happening in the scene. But it's, you know, we're always looking to how we can sort of grow and use this platform to celebrate what's happening with the artists and with the music from across this country. So we're looking into what that can mean, and we hope to work with those artists and work with the sector to see what best shape this event could take.
Mark Smith is the Executive Director of Music NT, the awards event producer, and ending that report by Kevin Suarez.
Hi, I'm Ray Martin. You're listening to The Wire on community and Indigenous radio right across Australia. Stay well.
And that's it for The Wire today. You can find all of our stories online at thewire.org.au, or you can subscribe to our podcast on iTunes or your favourite download app. We're also on Facebook and Twitter. Just search for The Wire Radio, or one word. The Wire, of course, is a team effort from 4EB in Brisbane, Radio Adelaide, and 2SER 107.3 here in Sydney. You can hear us on your radio or online across Australia weekdays. We're going to be back again tomorrow, reporting from Adelaide, so please tune in again then. Today's program came from the studios of Radio 2SER 107.3 here in Sydney. The Wire is produced on Gadigal country of the Eora Nation. I'm Roderick Chambers. Thanks for your company. Thank you.
We'll be right back.